Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated January 13th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's front page news, top of the fold, strategy shifted, power secure, grows jobs, by Chris Bagley from Wake Forest. Energy company Power Secure International Incorporated expects to add about 100 employees to its roster of 540 this year, a 15% increase as it strengthens an emphasis on its growing electricity-related business. CFO Chris Hutter says the company has been hiring an average of 15 people each month since March and plans to continue that pace at least through June. "These are great jobs," says PowerSecure CEO Sidney Hinton. "We're looking for spectacular people." The company is looking for engineers and utility crew personnel. Salaries are at and above local medians, from $40,000 to $120,000 annually. The company, whose clients include grocery stores, electrical utilities, and large-scale power users, collected some $43 million in early 2011 from the sale of two business lines that served fossil fuels industries. PowerSecure used the proceeds to eliminate its $10 million in long-term debt, upgrade a factory, and expand the fleet of vehicles it uses to deliver equipment and install generators for customers, according to its regulatory filings and interviews with executives. The two divested businesses were profitable, and PowerSecure reported gains when it's them, according to its filings. Hutter says the company had mulled selling the two businesses for years, but plans were derailed by the financial crisis and tight credit until last year, as would-be buyers struggled to come up with the money. Hutter says that the company's three remaining business lines have greater long-term potential for growth and profitability, and that the new investments are already helping to maximize that. PowerSecure's annual revenue grew 31% in 2011 to $128 million and could grow another 16% in 2012, according to estimates by Eric Stein of Northland Capital Markets. The company is scheduled to report its fourth quarter and full year financials on March 8th. Numbers to date indicate that growth in the three continuing segments is more than offsetting the $19 million in annual revenue represented by Southern Flow, the Louisiana-based subsidiary that PowerSecure sold to a Canadian gas company in January 2011. About 150 people worked there, Hutter said. Since early last year, the company has added 150 new jobs at the total three electric businesses, bringing its total employment back to about 540. Hutter says the new positions are in Wake Forest, Research Triangle Park, and Greensboro, with the focus on crews that serve the company's utility customers. PowerSecure also is hiring engineers for the utilities business and for its LED lighting business. It now employs about 80 at its Wake Forest headquarters, 60 at a facility in RTP, and 40 in Greensboro at the upgraded factory, Hutter says. That factory makes generators and other hardware for what PowerSecure calls distributed generation, the fastest growing of its three business lines. PowerSecure sets up the generating units at factories and other large power users and operates them, up to 1,200 of them at last count, during times of peak power demand, for example, on hot afternoons. The units essentially take the place of the peaker plants that utilities fire up to meet such demand. Their small size allows them to shut off and on quickly in response to relatively small changes in demand, but it also makes them inefficient and expensive. Utilities offer incentives to both businesses and residential customers to cut back during such time to limit their reliance on peakers. Progress's program, for example, now includes 14 large customers that have volunteered to give up a total of 13.5 megawatts, spokesman Jeff Brooks says. They replace about 70% of that with alternate generation, such as what PowerSecure provides. The other 30% represents reduced usage, Brooks says. A customer who volunteers for a 200-kilowatt capacity reduction gets $10,000 up front, $500 per month and $1,000 every time its power is actually shut off. We see it as a way to address peak customer demand without having to build additional generation, Brooks says. PowerSecure has also been reporting double-digit growth in a segment that handles construction and maintenance for electrical utilities directly. A third business line makes ultra-efficient light-emitting diodes for refrigerated display cases and other environments that require light without the wasteful heat generated by incandescent and fluorescent bulbs. That business shrank slightly in 2011, but Stein says he expects it to rebound strongly in 2012. PowerSecure began life in the early 1990s as a subsidiary of Metratech, a Colorado-based company that served oil and gas companies. It grew out of the parent but soon acquired Southern Flow, which provided installation, maintenance, and measurement services to drillers, and a 40% stake in a company now called WaterSecure, whose equipment is used to contain wastewater from the hydraulic fracturing, a process for extracting natural gas. PowerSecure sold the two businesses last year for $27 million and $15.6 million, respectively. Still on the front page, Bill Shore, face of GSK for 27 years, is to retire. This article is by Jason DeBruin and comes to us from the Research Triangle Park. In the past 5 years alone, pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline has donated more than $28 million to causes in the Triangle. Now, after 27 years with the company, the man who oversaw that corporate giving will retire. And Glaxo officials say they are evaluating the company's strategy with Shore's position going forward. Anyone involved with area nonprofits knows the name Bill Shore, age 62, the community ambassador for GSK, which employs about 4,500 in the Research Triangle Park, the company's North American headquarters. Born and raised in Durham, Shore essentially built the company's community relations department from the ground up. Starting with Glaxo Incorporated, Shore stayed with the company's community relations as it became a Glaxo Welcome, and then GSK after a merger with SmithKline Beecham in 2000. He's an influential, good person who really has the best interest of the community and his business at heart, says Jim Green, Senior Vice President of Resource Development for the United Way of the Greater Triangle, a recipient of GSK donations. You just really can't replace somebody like Bill Shore. In the early days, Glaxo Incorporated would donate a percentage of its profit, Shore says, but that changed along the way, and GSK now decides on a set amount to invest in the community. Most years, the company invests about one-third of that money in the Triangle. The rest is split between Philadelphia, where GSK employs 5,000, and worldwide donations with the global decisions made at company headquarters in the United Kingdom. As for what causes to support, Shore says he constantly worked to know the needs of the Triangle. It's our job to have our finger on the pulse of the local community and know what the needs are. Shore says, we do not want to be known as a company that just writes a check. That applies especially to programs involving education or workforce development, two areas Shore especially wanted to impact. In 2010, GSK gave $5.2 million in the Triangle. In total, it gave $345 million around the world, but that figure included the dollar amount attributed to donated pharmaceuticals, a large percentage of its corporate giving. Shore did not oversee any product donation. That year, the company reported $4.9 billion of profit on $44 billion of sales. Income figures are on pace for a better year in 2011. The company reported $6.7 billion of profit on $33 billion of total sales for the first 9 months of 2011. Shore's last day at the office will be February 3rd, and at this point, the company has not chosen anyone to fill the role, says Michael Fleming, head of reputation strategy and stakeholder engagement, which oversees Shore's department. Fleming would not say if GSK wanted to hire internally or externally, saying only that the company is looking at how best to move forward. The fact is, someone like Bill is irreplaceable, Fleming says. It takes years to develop the relationships he had in the community. That said, Shore built a strong culture at GSK, and Green says he does not expect a decrease in giving. We have connections at many levels, Green says. I have a hard time really worrying too hard about it. A decrease in community support, that is. Shore's resume, Shore's resume in community service is a lengthy one, extending well beyond the Triangle. Among many others, he served on boards and or as officer of Ronald McDonald House in Durham, communities and school in North Carolina, the Arthur Ashe Institute for Urban Health in New York, the North Carolina Public School Forum, the North Carolina Central University Board of Trustees, the Regional Transportation Alliance, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. In retirement, Shore says he plans to play more golf. He now owns a house on the number 4 fairway of Pinehurst number 3 and also wants to stay plugged into the community. He wants to start the Cindy Shore Foundation for Early Education in honor of his late wife, who taught kindergarten for 2 decades. He'll also start a small consulting outfit and continue to work on nonprofit boards of directors. At the bottom of the fold from the front page, Fox 50 on the Move, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, in Durham. The WRAZ-TV Fox 50 station in Durham will leave its perch overlooking the Durham Bulls Athletic Park and be relocated to Raleigh this summer. Executives with Capital Broadcasting Company, the parent company of both WRAZ-TV and the Triangle's market CBS affiliate WRAL-TV, have decided to consolidate equipment used to broadcast television programming for both stations into a central location. We just built a whole new technical plant for WRAL-TV, and now is the time to put them together, says Jim Goodman, president and CEO of Capital Broadcasting. It's for economy of operation. About 35 people working for WRAZ-TV in Durham will make the move to WRAL building on Western Boulevard in Raleigh, he says. The WRAL building is being expanded by about 15,000 square feet to accommodate the additional staff. Tommy Schenck, vice president and general manager of WRAZ-TV, says he'll mostly miss the views of the Bulls ballpark and the ongoing activity at the nearby American Tobacco campus in downtown Durham. WRAZ's office is on the first floor of the Diamond View 1 office building that overlooks the right field wall of the ballpark. But this is high-demand real estate, Schenck concedes. Capital Broadcasting is also the owner and developer of the Diamond View office buildings and the American Tobacco campus nearby. Goodman says his company's real estate operation, headed by his son Michael Goodman, is seeking a tenant to backfill the space WRAZ will be vacating. The Durham Bureau for WRAL News also will be moved out of Diamond View 1 to office space in American Tobacco, although Goodman says he plans to keep a news studio in the Diamond View 1 building. WRAZ-TV became the Triangle affiliate for the Fox Broadcasting Company network in 1998, after Fox decided not to renew a contract with Sinclair Broadcast Group. Goodman says the reason he moved WRAZ to Durham in the first place was to give the television station its own identity. "I didn't want Fox to be in the shadow of WRAL in the WRAL building," he says. "Get them out there on their own. Get them established. Now we're one of the top 10 Fox affiliates in the United States," he says. With consolidation to Capital Broadcasting's Raleigh campus, WRAZ and WRAL will share master control equipment that manages the programming sent by CBS and by Fox, Schenck says. Most of the WRAZ staffers who will relocate are involved in sales, creative services, and programming. "We've been doing more and more together behind the scenes anyway," he says. "It makes sense for us to be together." WRAZ-TV, for example, has always shared local news coverage produced by WRAL News, using WRAL on-air talent for the Fox station's news broadcast at 8 a.m. and 10 p.m. Bill Kalkoff, president of Downtown Durham Incorporated, says that while it's been nice seeing signage for both the Fox 50 and the competing ABC 11 WTVD TV stations visible along Downtown Durham's building skyline, he expects it won't take Capital Broadcasting long to find a replacement tenant for the Diamond View 1 building. "There's no loss of employees there. It'll just be different ones," Kalkoff says. Moving inside the front cover, state looks for ways to repay $2.6 billion to the feds, by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. The North Carolina Commerce Department will soon hire a consultant to study ways the state can repay $2.6 billion it borrowed from the federal government to cover jobless benefits during the economic downturn. Business groups already are bracing themselves for a final report calling for an increase in the state tax that North Carolina companies pay to support the unemployment system. It's a prospect that's put them on alert. We're following the issue closely, says John Goodman, Director of Governmental Affairs for the North Carolina Chamber. The business community wants to be at the table on this because we are the ones who would be affected. Under a state government reorganization, the Employment Security Commission of North Carolina, or ESC, was moved to the Commerce Department and renamed the Division of Employment Security, or DES. Commerce is expected to spend up to $250,000 on the consultant study and has been negotiating with the Boston-based Lucas Group, which performed a similar task for the state of South Carolina. Lucas was the only firm to submit a proposal to the state by the deadline. Once hired, the consultant will have 45 days to complete the review and deliver options, says Commerce spokesman Tim Crowley. Recommendations would have to be acted on by the General Assembly, which will begin a 2012 short session in May. North Carolina is among 33 states that borrowed a total of more than $40 billion from the U.S. Labor Department since rising layoffs began in 2008, exhausted at state-level unemployment benefits reserves. Businesses pay a two-step levy to support unemployment benefits, a federal tax, and a state levy into a trust fund. Because the state didn't repay the $2.6 billion it borrowed by 2011, the federal portion of the tax paid by North Carolina companies already has increased by 0.3% on 2011 tax bills due to the Internal Revenue Service on January 31st. Now the consultants' reviews will examine potential hikes in the state portion of the tax as well. Connie Wilson, a lobbyist for the Employers Coalition of North Carolina, ECNC, says her membership wants to see more in the financial consultants' report than just a call for higher business taxes. That would be short-sighted, she says, explaining that ECNC would also like to see the consultants review possible dollar savings in DES administrative costs and benefit packages. In North Carolina, the basic tax rate for companies is 1.2% on an employee's taxable wage base of $19,700. Well, that's not a universal amount. In fact, the rate a company pays can vary widely from 0% all the way up to 6.8%, depending on whether a firm strains the benefit system with a large number of laid-off workers. On average, North Carolina firms paid in about $281 per employee in 2010. Total taxes paid into the state trust fund that year were about $825 million. In an estimate made in early 2011, DES officials said they could make their trust fund solvent if they could collect an additional $700 million from the state-level tax. Another option that would permit the state to raise the $2.6 billion without a large business tax increase up front calls for the issuing of a special kind of bond called an unemployment insurance, or IU bond. Money to pay the bonds off comes from the unemployment trust fund that companies pay into, but stretched out over time. Various banks, RBC Capital Markets, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs have submitted plans on the subject that have made their way to the Commerce Department and the General Assembly. It's believed the consultant's report will examine the bond option. But I really don't have a warm and fuzzy feeling about that, says Representative Danny McComas, whose tax committee has examined the issue. Moving along, budget cuts hit UNC Dental School, by Jason DeBruin, from Chapel Hill. Even as the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill puts the finishing touches on a $117.5 million renovation and expansion of its School of Dentistry to educate more dentists, enrollment won't be boosted due to state budget cuts. The school raised $6.5 million from alumni and friends, and the state added $110 million for the new Dental Sciences Building, a four-story, 216,000-square-foot structure on Manning Drive that will include a 105-seat simulation laboratory. The school currently enrolls 320 dental students, 122 students in graduate specialty programs, and various other programs to total 547 students, according to Dr. Jane Weintraub, who took over as a School of Dentistry's dean on July 1st. Initially, plans were to increase student enrollment to about 100 per class or an additional 76 students, but state budget cutbacks restricted new faculty hires, putting those plans on hold. Unlike in the medical field, in which graduates go on to residency programs in hospitals, graduates of dental schools receive a license and can begin practicing general dentistry immediately. Only those seeking specialties return for more education. Because of that, educators supervise their students closer, and the UNC School of Dentistry boasts a ratio of one faculty member for every 8 students. To expand the student body, therefore, requires a larger investment than in other schools. Unfortunately, it is not just about hiring 2 or 3 more general dentist faculty, Weintraub says. Additional faculty in the different clinical specialties, like pediatric dentistry or oral surgery, would also be needed. In the 2011-12 year, the school lists 100 full-time faculty and 500 part-timers, though many of those come to campus only sporadically. In North Carolina, dentists aren't as scarce as family physicians, but there is a shortage of practicing dentists, particularly in rural areas, says Dr. Alec Parker, executive director of the North Carolina Dental Society. In the medical profession, about 80% of all doctors practice as a specialist, exacerbating the shortage. In dentistry, however, that distribution is flipped, with only about 20% of all dentists in specialties. As for distribution to rural areas, however, the same challenges face doctors and dentists, largely because of the economics of surviving in a rural area, especially when it can cost as much as $500,000 to open a new dental practice, he says. Still, bringing more dental care to rural, often low-income areas is a high priority for Dr. Mark Casey, dental director in the North Carolina Division of Medical Assistance, which oversees Medicaid distribution. In 2001, 1 out of every 5 children in the Medicaid program received dental services, he says. That grew to 1 out of 2 children in 2011. That's been promising, he says, especially pointing out that forming good dental and oral hygiene habits at an early age can significantly lower the risk for serious problems in later life. Helping ease the problem in North Carolina was the opening this year of a dental school at East Carolina University, which enrolled 52 students in its first class. It became only the 2nd accredited dentistry school in the state and the 62nd in the United States. In 2009-10, all U.S. dentistry schools combined to enroll 20,052 students, according to the American Dental Association. On a nationwide average, dentists earn between $61,000 and $211,000 annually, according to a PayScale report. Next up, million-dollar bargains. Most expensive home sales in 2011 reveal sector's state. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. This article is located in Raleigh. A Georgian-style home near Raleigh's North Hills, featuring a curved staircase, manicured rose garden, and a floor plan designed for entertaining, commanded the highest price for a residential property sold in the Greater Triangle in 2011. Todd Robinson, a Raleigh businessman and chairman of the William Peace University Board of Directors, paid $2.4 million for the 7,760-square-foot home on a one-acre lot. He got a deal, as did many in the current market. The same home was sold for nearly $3 million to a couple from Charleston, South Carolina in 2005. It's a testament to the fall in prices for even the biggest homes and the best locations in the Triangle over the past 3 years, says Wes Minton, a real estate agent with Prudential YSU, who has been selling homes in some of Raleigh's tiniest neighborhoods for nearly 30 years. Savvy buyers are well aware that owners of properties with distressed loans may knock off several thousand dollars from their asking prices, and Minton says buyers are still willing to wait for what they want. Bank-owned houses sell for less than they should because the bank wants to take them off their books, he says, and that's affecting the market still. Minton notes that 6 of the 15 homes sold for more than $1 million in Raleigh's Inside the Beltline neighborhoods in 2011 were properties that were either owned by banks or short sales that required lender approval. The second most expensive home sale in the region was $1.85 million paid for the home at 611 Transylvania Avenue in the Country Club Hills neighborhood. But even that deal required some creativity on the part of the builders and their bank. Built in 2008, local custom builders Duncan Ray and Stephen Edwards had tried for 3 years to find a buyer for their five-bedroom spec home. In December, they were able to negotiate a deal for the 7,037-square-foot home that includes a house trade with the buyers, a 3,245-square-foot home on Little Lake Hill Drive in Raleigh, according to deed records. The bulk of the highest-priced home sales in the Triangle were either within Raleigh's established Inside the Beltline neighborhood or in Chapel Hill, where homes around the Chapel Hill Country Club and in Chapel Hill's historic neighborhoods still command high dollars. Lynn Zimmerman, a real estate agent with REMAX Winning Edge in Chapel Hill, put her own 8,368-square-foot home at 108 Donegal Street in Chapel Hill on the market after she started seeing a more steady stream of potential buyers shopping around. Last year, people looked around but did not buy, she says. This year, 2011, we had active interest in high-end homes that actually sold. Zimmerman noted that many of the buyers of big homes in Chapel Hill in 2011 were lawyers and business executives transferring into the Triangle, not administrators and faculty affiliated with the university. The only reason why we don't have more inventory sold here is because people can't sell their homes elsewhere, she says. Even retired NBA basketball star Rasheed Wallace, who helped take the UNC Chapel Hill men's basketball team to the NCAA Final Four in 1995, was able to hook a deal for a 5,868-square-foot home on a 20-acre estate on Kepley Road in Chapel Hill. Wallace, who also owns a home in Durham where his mother lives, paid $1.5 million for the Chapel Hill property. Andy Andrews of Raleigh, president and CEO of Dominion Realty Partners commercial real estate development firm, counts himself among the lucky ones who were able to sell their high-end homes in 2011 in less than a year. You may get killed on the sale price, but you can still do very well on the buy side, Andrews says, noting that he was able to buy two homes for the price of one, following the $1.6 million sale of his family's home on Williamsboro Court. Continuing on to the inside of the Triangle Business Journal, this article is entitled Raleigh Firm Rolling Bets on Company, Facebook Offering, by Lee Weisbecker. VisionQuest, a Raleigh-based wealth manager and opportunity investor, is raising $10 million that will be infused into a single company. VisionQuest CEO Stephen Peters says that fewer than 10 investors are expected to take part in the deal, and at this point he is declining to identify the target firm. If you would like to check back with us within the next 120 days, I will be able to provide you with additional details, he wrote in an email response to questions. VisionQuest disclosed the fundraiser in a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. According to filing, investors are committing a minimum of $500,000 each to buy shares in an entity called Southeast Industrial Acquisition, a limited liability company set up in September 2011, according to records maintained by the Office of the North Carolina Secretary of State. As of the date of the filing, $1 million had been raised. We are making an investment into a specific opportunity, specific investment, not a sector, Peters wrote. A company using both the words Southeast and Industrial prominently in its name is Charlotte-based Southeast Industrial Equipment, which sells and rents a range of heavy equipment in the Carolinas, Virginia, and Georgia. Attempts to reach Southeast Vice President B.J. Farrell were not successful. Peter's VisionQuest is comprised of two units, the wealth management arm set up in 2005 that now provides a range of services to more than 60 families, each with assets starting at around $20 million. In its advisor registration statement with the SEC, the firm's wealth management arm reported in May that it had $21 million under management. The second arm is VisionQuest Capital, founded in 2008, which engages in structuring mergers and acquisitions and investment banking deals. In one 2011 deal, VisionQuest raised about $1 million from 30 investors in North Carolina and Georgia to participate in a pending Facebook IPO. Peters obtained shares in the now private tech company. We will most likely buy additional shares within the next 45 days at a price we hope will be less than IPO, he says. It's projected the Facebook offering will be one of the biggest stock debuts of 2012. New York-based Second Market, an online exchange for private company stock, maintains a listing of more than 12,000 potential investors, watchers they are called, following the availability of Facebook shares and willing to bid on them. That gives Facebook a watcher ranking of number one, the highest possible, says Second Market's Maggie Langdon. A second exchange for private company shares, California-based SharesPost, used pre-IPO stock transactions to formulate the implied value of companies. It lists Facebook at $75 billion, according to the firm's David Weir. Keep your fingers crossed that this play works out for our firm and our investors, Peters says. Next up, data. Dip belted small owners from Gris Bagley. From Raleigh. Sole proprietors in North Carolina saw their incomes shrink more dramatically and much earlier than the Great Recession than most other taxpayers, according to data recently released by the IRS. Analysts say the data reflects a sharp decline in consumer spending and businesses' general difficulties in adjusting their own spending, particularly on labor. While business income began to decline in 2007, most of the resulting layoffs and wage freezes didn't follow until 2009, these analysts say. IRS data released in December shows sole proprietors in North Carolina reported net income of $5.26 billion on their 2009 tax returns, down from $5.82 billion in 2008, and from a peak of $6.31 billion in 2007. The average sole proprietor reported $7,900 in income, a 10% decline from 2008, followed by a 4% decline from 2007. A sole proprietorship is not a formally incorporated and has only one owner, who typically reports his income on the IRS's Schedule C as part of his or her personal tax return, IRS spokesman Mark Hansen says. Some of the businesses are a primary source of income, while others are profitable hobbies for owners who work full-time or draw retirement income. About 70% of sole proprietors in North Carolina had adjusted gross income of less than $50,000 in 2009, while 11% of AGIs had more than $100,000, according to IRS data. Their sharp declines in income in 2009 contrast with shallower and later declines among employees and shareholders. The average North Carolinian with wage or salary income reported $43,200 in 2009, a 1% decline from 2008 that followed several years of gains between 2 and 4%, according to the IRS. Individuals' dividend income dropped to $1,023 in 2009, a 26% decline. Analysts caution that the numbers can be imprecise because so many factors can change from year to year. Some businesses launch, others disappear, and still others incorporate, all skewing the IRS's numbers for sole proprietorship. Still, the agency's numbers are accurate in emphasizing a larger point, says Will McBride, a chief economist at the Tax Foundation, a nonprofit research organization in Washington, D.C. The recession was brutal for businesses. U.S. businesses' total income hit a peak of $1.19 trillion in 2006 before falling sharply, McBride says, citing IRS data. On other measures, it hit new record highs in 2010 and probably again in 2011, he says. Bill Dunkelberg, chief economist for the National Federation of Independent Businesses, says small businesses bore the brunt of the recession. They included fewer exporters and corporations and other large companies, and thus had a thinner lifeline to the continued economic growth in China and other Asian countries. And the recession was marked by a sharp drop in consumer spending, Dunkelberg says, particularly in the early stages. That hurt small businesses disproportionately since they rely more heavily on individual customers rather than business clients. And now for a little local travel. dueling Raleigh rickshaw operators agree to coexist. By Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Downtown Raleigh's two pedicab services have settled a legal quarrel and are getting back to business, with new ventures in a new year when downtown itself is expecting changes. Raleigh Rickshaw, the larger and more established of the two, aims to branch out and launch a bicycle sharing system. Owner Donald Mertrude says it also is adding to the themed leisure rides, special events, and basic downtown transportation that it offers. Crank Arm Rickshaw, which launched last year, also plans to expand its business. The company survived a lawsuit that all but aimed to shut it down. Raleigh Rickshaw sued the upstart in Wake County Superior Court in June, alleging that it was founded and run by a former Raleigh Rickshaw driver in violation of a non-compete contract. The two companies settled the suit and a countersuit on December 2nd, according to court records. The owners declined to discuss the settlement's terms, but drivers for both are back on the streets and pounding the pavement for business. For the record, a rickshaw is a passenger cab pulled by a driver on foot. A pedicab, or cycle rickshaw, is a passenger cab propelled by a driver on a cycle. Raleigh's two companies operate only pedicabs, though both use rickshaw in their names. The services make money by collecting rental fees from drivers, typically $20 to $30 for a 4 to 5 hour shift, and from advertising and sponsorship fees. New pedicabs cost from $3,000 to $4,000. After paying the rental fee, a driver keeps the fares and tips he or she collects from the passengers, as little as $20 or as much as several hundred dollars per shift, depending on the weather, events downtown, and other factors, drivers say. Mertrude founded Raleigh Rickshaw in early 2007. It takes passengers mainly in the area bounded by Peace and South Streets and the Oakwood and Boylan Heights neighborhoods, Mertrude says. The pedicabs also are available for special events at corporate campuses and for leisure rides, such as the romance-themed ride it's introducing for Valentine's Day this year, Mertrude says. As for the new bike share lane of line of business, Mertrude says he got the city's go-ahead last summer. It will resemble sharing systems in New York, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., and numerous European cities in which customers check out bikes from automated stations, near transit stations, and other high-traffic areas. He plans to launch the service after getting a corporate sponsor to chip in for naming and branding rights, he says. The plan is to get a sponsor whose products or services promote a healthy lifestyle. We're not going to get a Bud Light, for example, he says. If that service gets going this year, it will happen as downtown gets at least one new corporate tenant, the software company Red Hat, which plans to move 750 to 1,000 people, mostly relatively young, into space being vacated by Progress Energy. Mertrude's lawsuit last year focused on a crank arm driver, Dylan Sillinger, who worked with Mertrude's company. Crank Arm countersued, alleging that Mertrude and his drivers had harassed them and used foul language to drive away customers. Crank Arm owner Adam Eckhart and his drivers are back in the saddle. In contrast to Raleigh Rickshaw, which assigns 2 to 20 green-shirted drivers to each shift, Crank Arm has just 3 pedicabs. Eckhart says he plans to buy at least one more cycle this year. Mertrude's company, too, is getting back up to speed after the alleged theft of $480 and the loss of at least half a dozen drivers last fall. In a September 25 email to the company's drivers, which one forwarded to a Triangle Business Journal, Mertrude said a driver had pried into a lockbox where the pedicabs were stored and taken 2 days' worth of rental payments. He suspended 4 drivers whom he couldn't rule out as the thief and added $2 per shift to drivers' rental fees. Several drivers resented the accusations and the increased fees and quit. Mertrude said he hasn't heard of any theft and called the story scuttlebutt. Next up, branch closings. Back office cuts figure into PNC cost cuts. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. A 13% workforce reduction that PNC Financial will implement as part of its takeover of Raleigh-based RBC Bank USA will just be the Pittsburgh Bank's opening move in a litany of other cost-cutting actions expected to come over the coming months. Branch consolidation in 10 deep South markets, back-office computer system modifications, and reduced capital funding costs round out the list of other potential moves, according to analysts. PNC's announced workforce reduction, 196 in Wake County and 425 in Rocky Mount, 621 in all, is aimed at putting the bank on a path towards reaching its goal of $150 million in cost savings from the RBC footprint. That figure, PNC CEO James Rohrer says he wants to reach in the first 12 months following the acquisition, which is expected to be finalized in March. RBC Bank USA, with 426 offices in six states and 4,747 employees, spent $280 million on salaries, benefits, through the first 9 months of 2011, according to the FDIC. Annualized, that figure is about $380 million. A 13% cut saves PNC around $50 million, about a third of the way to its goal. Where will the rest come from? Rochdale Securities analyst Richard Bove says back office changes, both in staffing and system hardware, produce savings well beyond the simple calculations of payouts for salaries and benefits. What they do basically is dismantle a back office, he says. It's typical technique. The old systems and products are just cleaned out. As for the people, the ones who are kept are those who can sell. That's really all you want to be left with, salespeople and customers. There will be some branch consolidation as well. PNC, with most of its offices stretching from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin, has purchased Florida and Georgia branch network independent of the RBC Bank deal. PNC spokesman Fred Solomon, without providing any hints of where the consolidations might come, says PNC hopes to achieve its savings goals without additional layoffs. Some branch workers, he added, might be redeployed. As a hint to where the branch consolidations might come was included in a Federal Reserve statement on why the central bank is approving PNC's $3.4 billion acquisition of RBC Bank, the U.S. banking arm of Royal Bank of Canada. The two banks compete directly at 10 local markets, the Federal Reserve analyst discovered: Brevard, Daytona Beach, Fort Pierce, Indian River, Miami-Fort Lauderdale, Naples, Orlando, Tampa Bay, and West Palm Beach, all in Florida. Also identified was the Atlanta market. There will be some branches cut, but really I wouldn't expect to see many on the list, says bank analyst Don Coker, who lives in Atlanta, one of the overlap areas. They will realize some savings here. So too, Coker believes, will PNC experience cost savings over time by reducing its capital fundraising costs. In selling bonds, for example, the interest PNC would have to pay investors presumably would be less than what RBC Bank would have to pay, he says. Those are the kinds of capital savings that are part of the total savings to be realized. In consummating the deal, according to the Federal Reserve statement on the transaction, PNC became the nation's fifth largest bank, holding 2.2% of all U.S. insured deposits, a number put at $8.9 trillion. It becomes the ninth largest bank in Florida and the eighth largest in Georgia. Under Dodd-Frank financial reform, the Fed, in looking at mergers, must consider whether the combined entity would pose a threat to the entire U.S. financial system if things went sour later on. In a 17-page statement signed by Fed Secretary Robert DeFreeson and approved by Chairman Ben Bernanke and four other Fed governors, the agency says no such systemic threat exists. In fact, the statement says PNC's size, $263 billion, does not rise to the level where the board would be inclined, solely on that basis, to restrict its ability to make a $27 billion acquisition. Next up, medical board relents, a men's order on potty reprimand, by Jason DeBrun, from Raleigh. In a bow to complaints from Duke University General Counsel Ann Bradley, the North Carolina Medical Board has taken the rare step of amending an order it had issued, in this case an order regarding fabricated research by former Duke researcher Dr. Anil Patti. In its initial consent order, issued on November 22, 2011, the Medical Board referenced an internal investigation by Duke to essentially give Patti a slap on the wrist, stating, quote, "While there were some inaccuracies on the biographical sketch and curriculum vitae, they were largely the result of carelessness and honest errors with no clear intention to mislead," end quote. That order prompted a response from Bradley in the form of a December 5 letter she sent to the medical board stating that Duke found the board's characterization of Potty's actions to be inaccurate and that the university takes issues with the representations made in reference to any conclusions drawn by Duke. Bradley further wrote, referencing in a statement by Duke Provost Peter Lange, that Duke identified issues of substantial concern in Potty's biographical information. Furthermore, the sheer number of errors in the information was a serious concern. After receiving the letter from Duke, the medical board changed the wording of its original order and pasted a modified order on its website on December 21st. It states that there were inaccuracies in Potty's biographical and scholarly information, leaving out any conclusion that might or might not have been drawn by the university's investigation. Potty, pronounced Potty, was required to sign both orders, with the end result being a reprimand by the North Carolina Medical Board, which oversees the conduct of medical professionals in the state. Bradley and other Duke representatives would not comment on the matter, citing litigation in which the university and various school leaders are named as defendants, along with Potty. Tom Mansfield, director of the North Carolina Medical Board's legal department, says a change to a consent order, especially one that is not a small typographical error, is, quote, infrequent, end quote. Indeed, of the 138 consent orders from 2010, no more than three were amended, says Gene Fisher Brinkley, Public Affairs Director for the North Carolina Medical Board. Potty fabricated cancer research, and various trials based on the research subsequently were halted. He has since made at least 11 malpractice payments made in his name and is facing various lawsuits by participants or estates of some who participated in some of those studies. He also lied about being a Rhodes Scholar and resigned from Duke in 2010. Public records show he is currently practicing at a coastal cancer center in Loras, South Carolina, near Myrtle Beach. Typically, the medical board initiates an investigation into a physician after learning of some apparent misconduct. After conducting its own investigation, the board will submit a report to Mansfield's office, which then goes about settling the matter. Frequently, as with most judicial cases, it is settled without a court hearing. Instead, an attorney for the medical board will write an order, which the offending physician will then consent to, and the consent order is then filed and made publicly available. This happened with the case against Potty. Sometimes the matter will go before a quasi-judicial proceeding with experts serving as the jury in an administrative court to reach a verdict, though this happened only 11 times in 2010, compared to the 138 consent orders that year. And now it's time for A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. United Way shifts focus to donor impact. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Reducing to 15,000 from 30,000 over the next 8 years, the number of low-income households in Durham, Johnston, Orange, and Wake counties that are financially unstable will be the focus of a new initiative United Way of the Greater Triangle plans to kick off later this year. Plans for the effort, which will focus on reducing housing costs, improving employment, and providing training and financial management, are being developed by volunteers, donors, and nonprofits, and grew out of online surveys and face-to-face visits with donors, and from trends in the choices that donors make about the health and human services causes they want to support. The effort reflects an emerging business model for United Way, which traditionally has focused 95% of its fundraising on workplace giving and is now moving to be a donor-centric organization, says Jim Green, Senior Vice President for Development. The best way to satisfy our donors is to make a measurable impact in our community in a way that is apparent to the donor that it's helped them or someone they know and is a cause they care about, he says. While United Way did not publicly announce a goal for its annual campaign that began last fall, the campaign is falling short of United Way's internal goal of raising $17.5 million, including $9.8 million from donors who designate that their funds go to the Give United Fund, a general fund United Way can use at its discretion. United Way typically uses those dollars to address the priority needs of health care, income, safety, and education. Green says the shortfall in the campaign is the result of the weak economy and the fact that donors want more choice and involvement in the causes they support. United Way's new business model is based on focus groups, surveys, and donor visits, ongoing input that is designed to overcome the fact that the organization's main contact with donors traditionally has consisted of 5 minutes once a year in front of employee groups to promote its workplace campaign, Green says. While United Way traditionally has been seen as a black hole, he says, it is actually a galaxy of outcomes and results at the 149 programs and 82 partner agencies that United Way funds. When people donate, their dollars really go effectively to the most need, he says. But as a donor, it's hard to understand how your dollar is being used. That method of communication is labor-intensive and cannot effectively reach the nearly 26,000 individual donors who account for 83% of the dollars donated to the annual campaign, says Green. So in addition to surveys and focus groups, he says, United Way will be more active in using technology to better understand donors' interests, to help them understand the difference their dollars make in addressing causes they care about, and engage them in the organization's work. We can use information about what's most important to donors, Green says. It's how we affect change in the community. This week's guest column is from Mr. Andy Broad. Mr. Broad is a senior research fellow in UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. Can we please start the lending cycle? After an unnerving 2011, the economy is showing some encouraging signs as we begin 2012, but the economy is still pretty weak, and the prospect of a return to recession in Europe doesn't help. One of the factors weakening the U.S. economy is its financial sector. I don't mean that the sector itself is weak. Its profits have recovered strongly after plummeting 80% from 2006 to 2008. Industry profits are near an all-time high, even though nearly one-tenth of its workforce has been shed since 2006. Finance employs only 4% of all non-farm workers, but it accounts for about one-third of all corporate profits. But one has to ask the question, what is a financial sector for? If the answer is to trade for itself and generate profit, then it's doing a bang-up job. But the traditional purpose of finance is to enhance the fiscal operations of other industries and make them more productive. In this sense, financial activities are infrastructural in nature. A classic example involves a farmer who borrows money in the spring to buy seed but won't receive payments until the fall harvest. Without financial intermediaries connecting farmers with savers and investors, farmers will plant less and consumers will see higher prices and less produce. This is essentially the problem currently faced by small businesses and startups. In normal times, these businesses do a lot of hiring, but not now. Of course, one big reason is that consumers still aren't spending much. Another big reason is the dearth of financing. The demand for credit is strong and rising, but bank loans to small businesses are at their lowest point in 6 years and 15% lower than before the 2008 financial crisis. A recent Wells Fargo Gallup survey found that one-third of small businesses had difficulty securing credit. Even when loans are made, lenders are cautious to the extreme. It's increasingly rare for loans to be made against a purchase order, even against more solid assets like contracts and invoices, and it's tough to find a good rate. Many small entrepreneurs are forced to finance their businesses by taking out second mortgages and unwinding 401ks. Others are pursuing exotic approaches such as the crowdfunding, in which the entrepreneurs seek small amounts of money from large numbers of online funders. And of course, venture capitalists and angel investors are always out there. If the financial sector doesn't start lending to and investing in more small businesses, the economy's encouraging signs may be short-lived. It's one thing for a business to fail because it didn't meet customer demand. That's the market at work. But failing due to a prolonged credit crunch implies a dysfunctional financial market. Fortunately, the financing outlook for 2012 is also encouraging. For example, a new loan program by the Federal Small Business Administration has the potential to make loans for working capital more widely accessible. My interest in this issue is more academic because in addition to my affiliation with UNC Greensboro, I'm a principal in a startup business. Our company, Mattress Go Round, LLC, recycles and refurbishes mattresses for institutional clients such as colleges, hotels, and long-term care facilities. It's a green business. It saves customers money, and the response so far has been quite positive. But raising capital has been nearly impossible. Because of that, Mattress Go Round is hustling and finding creative ways to generate cash flow even without traditional financing. We'll be fine, but it shouldn't be this hard. A listing on website bizquest.com sure caught Biz's attention. It reads, hundreds of thousands of alumni, Tar Heel athletes, and former sorority and fraternity members alike have all shared good times and tons of beer in this historic setting. This establishment has become part of the allure of what it means to be a Tar Heel. It's practically a rite of passage. What it is a bar for sale in Chapel Hill, and although the listing says it's confidential, it is indeed a spot where tons of beer have been swilled over the years. Dave Kitzmiller, 76, has put on the market for sale He's Not Here, a bar he opened more than 35 years ago. The asking price is $165,000, and BizQuest lists gross annual revenue at $400,000. Where does the Queen of Soul like to eat when she comes to the middle of the Tar Heel State? Mebane, of course. Turns out Aretha Franklin had a hankering from some good old country fare and surprised Mebane Cracker Barrel diners on January 3rd when she stopped in for some dining and shopping. One member of our party came in and told me Aretha Franklin was with him and that they'd like to come in and ask if it was okay, says Ed Welburn, associate manager of the restaurant. I said, of course that's okay. She is a very gracious person, he says. She came in, sat down, ate, and shopped a bit. She even took pictures with people. It'll be a red-letter day, better make that a Carolina blue-letter day, for some 100 Special Olympic athletes on Sunday, January 15th at 1 o'clock, when UNC coach Roy Williams' staff and players greet them for a couple of hours of special instruction. It's the ninth year the Tar Heels have hosted Special Olympics North Carolina athletes. Here's hoping old Roy doesn't get too dadgum tough on the kids. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.